You're listening to Architecture Masters.
When I was much younger, I used to draw like Billy-O, and you know, it used to be nicknamed Billy Wiz sometimes for drawing too many drawings too quickly. We used to sell paintings door to door in Australia as a way of making a living.
You're listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. I'm Owen Wainhouse.
I'm Chris Dyson. I'm the principal of Chris Dyson Architects in Spitalfields, London.
On the programme this week is Chris Dyson, principal of Chris Dyson Architects, a multi-award-winning practice, much lauded for their sensitive conservation work on historic buildings in London. Chris originally studied architecture at Oxford Brookes University and then at the Mackintosh School of Architecture in Glasgow, before going on to spend 11 years working at James Sterling Michael Wilford & Associates. Chris then spent 3 years as a design director at Sir Terry Farrell's practice, from where, in 2003, he left to start his own firm. In today's episode, we speak about Chris's passion for drawing and his work for James Sterling. We talk about going to boarding school and walking the plank, about making grand plans, or at least plans to be grand. I joined Chris in his studio in a former pub in Spitalfields, where I began by asking where he found his calling for conservation architecture, especially after working for such renowned modernist architects.
It is, to some extent. It is a different calling in architecture, if you like. It's not one I set out in, but I remember doing my thesis at the Mackintosh School of Architecture in Glasgow, set in Istanbul, building upon the ruins of Topkapi, a university for UNESCO, and to, on a World Heritage site, which is kind of interesting idea to do as a student in a way, to propose something new in that setting, which is kind of eons of history. That was for me a formative thing, I think, which I've now carried through in practice as well. And I enjoy that straitjacket, if you like, of working with history, working with context. Without it, I think it's sort of, it's more difficult for me in particular. Although sometimes liberating on occasions. Yeah. The opportunities we've been going now 12 years as a practice that we've been presented with working in London are so so much to do with context, with history, with old buildings, that you can't really deny that. And to sweep away the past and to build anew is something which I think is an amazing privilege. But something I think which is a shame, because it eradicates stories, memories, communities, identity, so many aspects of human life, let alone architecture, that it's a really can be quite a dangerous thing to propose. And we've learnt that from post-war buildings. You know, streets, squares, and wonderful spaces in the East End in particular are still lost today by some brave new world utopian housing schemes, which we're all trying to make the best of now, and there's some very good architects who are doing good jobs and at mending those streets and mending those street patterns. But it's one that the path of working on historic buildings and conservation work in particular has become a real pleasure. And so every time we get a new project, we investigate its history, we investigate its potential for a new use, and really work the brief or the program into those projects.
And I mean, how much do you have to understand the, I guess, the thinking of the original architect and their designs, their ideas?
I think it's essential to understand who the architect was, his name, his background. The background in which he was working is almost as important, if not more important in many ways. And that's what I think about architecture in a way today, is we're working within a certain time frame, certain period of history that informs what we do.
Yeah.
We're not even aware of it, but it is in our fingers, in our bones, in our thinking. And the work we do now in the 21st century here in London is different to that of the 20th century and the 19th yeah. century. And every time we do a new project, we lay out a new plan, a new way of thinking. It's subconscious.
And are you conscious of the fact that the building, the kind of conservation work you're doing now might be revisited in 20, 50 years' time, someone else reinventing your reinvention in a...
I think one has to be, you have to have humility in architecture. I think it's important to understand that what you put forward might not be relevant in 30, 40 years' time. I'd like to think the bones of the architecture we create is flexible enough to remain and be useful, because that, in fact, is one of the biggest financial spends in any project, is quite often the structure and the yeah. kind of the infrastructure that creates space is costly. And you hope that that actually has a life. And that's often why we're engaged with the older buildings, because they basically are sound buildings.
Right.
But they need to be reinterpreted and readapted for new uses. So in a way, I would say the same of anything we do, that it should be capable of that in yeah. the future.
So the work for James Stirling before, I was chatting to Peter a couple of weeks ago about Number One Poultry and about some of James Stirling's work. It seems a big contrast to the work you're doing now.
Yeah, I was never directly involved in that project. It was one of those projects which came into the office before my time
right.
and was carried out during my time there. Okay. And the partner in charge was Lawrence Bain. But it was very much a project which was a period of time where things were really in a state of flux in terms of modern architecture and... Jim was part of this. He was quite a kind of bold modernist architect, really. Yeah. And even the postmodern architecture that's described as postmodern yeah. that he produced, which I think is a mislabel, really is bold modernism.
Yeah.
It is underneath it. It's concrete. It's solid. It's strong forms. It's quite uncompromising in many ways.
But even though you weren't working on, you were working on other buildings of that
yes,
James Stirling style,
yes, of course,
and that
yeah.
that style is very different to the style of work you're doing now?
Yes. Oh, I think so. I think I was very much working on to begin with competitions such as the Paris Library, the Tokyo Forum, the Kyoto Forum, and then latterly the Bilbao Interchange projects. And those were very big, bold, modern projects, which were quite, to some degree, quite mannered in terms of their formal compositions, which is quite different from the work I'm doing now. And yes, their scale is civic. Their architecture, perhaps more monumental, and I think the work that I produce now tends to be, at the moment, is more of a kind of domestic scale, more smaller scale architecture, but still I believe it has a richness and integrity in terms of its planning and the diagram. One thing I learned from Jim was that the power of the diagram is just, so once you get the diagram right in the flow of the circulation, the order of the spaces, the hierarchy of spaces, the rest follows in a way, and it's always from the plan.
So by diagram, for a non-architect, you mean...
Yeah, I suppose the diagram is literally the sketch you put on paper which arranges the right, position okay. of rooms on a plan.
Okay.
It's the entrance, it's the address to the street, it's yeah. The arrangement of rooms around a staircase, for example.
And then developing a house style at Chris Dyson Architects, is that, I'm wondering where that's, after working at with Stirling, worked at Farrell's
yeah.
for a while, both different styles, you know, to a different house style you have now. But what's, you know, is that something you developed working with others, or is it something, you know, that's been with you from the early days?
One of the pleasures I think we have is that perhaps we don't have a house style. Okay. It's interesting that you say that we might, but it's not one I'm conscious of. I'm always like suggesting to people, don't try and reinvent the wheel when it comes to detailing and things, because once we've got a good detail, that's useful to evolve and to develop. But when it comes to an elevation or a certain materiality in the buildings, an approach, I think, is more, it's a much broader way of dealing with the building. And to build a brick building is something which engages the language of brick in many ways. And we've done a number of brick buildings, and we are, I suppose you will see there's a certain similarity or cross-fertilization of ideas between projects, but each one tends to work within its context. And we do love deep reveals. We do love bronze. We do love dark brickwork and
heavy materials.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because, I mean, you know, we find ourselves in London in this context, which is largely a brick city, or a series of villages that make a brick city, and it's it is actually a wonderful material. The more civic buildings tend to be in stone, and we're just doing a building in the park in Crystal Palace, for example, which starts on site soon, which is clad in cedar shingles. So that's another unusual material for us. And we chose cedar there because cedar was, the half rounded shingles resembled a sort of idea of a dinosaur's skin. And there in the park is this wonderful collection of dinosaurs from 1825. And from the Great Exhibition. And it's those sort of things which I really enjoy to bring into a project to create ideas and to generate a sense of place.
Almost maybe a kind of sense of house idea rather than house style, maybe, do you think? Is that a...
I think it's important the building... I don't think a building is a built idea. That's too crass. I think buildings are much more sophisticated than that. I think they are very, you know, basically functional and they have to be practical. But I think there's definitely something that you can say in a project, there should be some idea of why it is the way it is.
But as a practice, you have something in common. You know, the people who work for a practice have... Is it an idea in common? Is it a, I'm wondering how you, as a principal of a practice, you know, you have your ideas and people working in the practice buy into that, I guess, buy into those ideas. I'm wondering how in a practice that carries your name, you know, I was chatting a bit to Mary about a similar thing, really. How do you engage your team on those? And how do they pick up from you your sense of style or ideas or way of thinking that drives the... And, I mean, that's, I guess, what clients are buying into when they pick up Chris Dyson Architects for a project. They're buying into your...
Yeah, it's an identity thing, isn't it? It's identity in many things. But I think people come to you as a practice to come and work for you as young students. Yeah. And that's how a lot of our staff, you know, people... come through as students, and we train up part threes. They come because they like the work that we do. There's something about it that attracts them to it and resonates with their own view of the world. I think I'm generous enough as a principal to allow them to develop within the practice. And with my partners Gideon and Matthew, I think they've definitely felt that they can develop projects, but within the framework, if you like, of an approach. I wouldn't call it an ideology, but it is to do with the way of conceiving buildings and looking at the past and looking at the future. And
a way integrating of thinking.
A way of thinking, yeah exactly. And I think I would rather we were a more thought-provoking, thoughtful practice than somebody who creates or a practice that makes very flashy images. Yeah. That's not really our background or our future, I think. I think we're more considered. And it is something that sometimes I reflect upon and think, well, you know, perhaps if I was more brash and as a practice, if we were more brash and we did more sort of outlandish projects, perhaps we would win bigger scale projects. Mm-hmm. But I don't think so. And I think one has to sort of be content with oneself and listen to one's inner voice. And yeah. I think that's what I encourage in other people in my practice, and certainly those who come and go, to sort of reflect on what they're doing before committing.
Right. And so how many now in the practice?
We're 16 at the moment. Yeah. We sort of fluctuate around 16 to 18. At the summer holidays, we tend to kind of take on a few more just to help us make models. And yeah. That's something we love doing, is to realise the projects, even though they're often within existing contexts, within cardboard models. So we use model making as a very important technique in the practice.
It's interesting you were talking about CGIs and about flashy, kind of Mary was talking about much the same thing, about wanting to perhaps use clay and materials to convey ways of thinking to clients.
I think I learned from Jim the art of drawing.
Right.
If you like. I enjoyed the art of drawing before I went to work for him, but then I discovered a whole other way of art of drawing. Wow, that was amazing. A wonderful experience in the school of drawing, really. Right. Was. And one day I hope there'll be a really big exhibition of his drawings from right up to the point where he died, because there were some incredible drawings produced. Right. By the office. I know that a lot of people are familiar with some of the up-view, down-views. Yeah. Of the postmodern style of buildings. Yeah. That we referred to earlier, but I think there are also some very good drawings from later periods of the work as well. And a lot of the people who went through the office still today cherish drawing as a way of conveying ideas. And so I try to encourage my own office, and certainly they are aware of it, that I love good drawings. And so I don't mind them investing a lot of time in creating a good drawing at the right time of the project. Yeah. to convey the materiality or the spatial qualities of a building. It's quite an unusual thing, particularly when you have computers today, that you yeah. print something out and you frame it and put it on the wall. it gets celebrated at the RA, and quite rightly too, but yeah. there's a very limited field for it.
Yeah.
Most drawings are about documenting construction, and they're quite dry.
Yeah.
But that said, it is a beautiful medium.
As someone who draws, you sit down. I mean, is that the very first? Is that where your concepts are put onto paper initially, or is it drawing at a later stage that you're trying to develop an idea?
It's interesting you say that, because when I was much younger, I used to draw like Bilio, and. You know, so I used to be nicknamed Billy Wiz sometimes for drawing too many drawings too quickly. But I would love that process so much that I'd try and express an idea quickly on paper and draw it all out, plan, section, elevation. And so produce options, if you like. And as I've got slightly older and more, wiser, yeah. shall we say, yeah. I've tried to restrict my energies to try and think more about what I'm doing before I commit to paper. But having said that, it's never too late. It's never too early to commit to paper, I think, in some ways. I think you need to sometimes get these things out and draw them and test them. And it is that act of testing ideas, yeah. and plans and thoughts that is so important in making a good, well-considered building. It's not something that just falls out like that, you know.
And that, I wonder whether you're often, I guess, presenting hand-drawn images to clients. Are the sort of clients who are interested maybe in conservation more, I guess, are they happier with seeing hand-drawn images?
On the whole, most of our clients come, they admire the hand-drawn You know, we do these pencil 1:50 kind of elevational style drawings, very dark window reveals, yeah. all the texture on the brickwork. They love that sort of thing. And they go, when are we going to get to that stage? I'd love to frame my drawing. On the whole, most don't come to us for a dramatic fly-through, walk-through kind of view of the world. Because I think we're not doing that sort of project. We're not showing a shopping mall or something like that. We're showing a streetscape or a garden or a an office environment or a restaurant, you know, and or an art gallery. And it's those sort of, they tend to be more static and more, there's no need to be sort of driven through the space.
So I guess we're sort of slightly coming back to a lot of your work in Asia, you know, some of the finance tower in Shenzhen, various big international projects. Seems very different to me as an outsider, as an amateur, to the sort of projects you're working on now, which are, by contrast, they're local and they're London projects a lot, you know, UK-based projects, and they're not huge skyscrapers. That transition is interesting, I think, and where, what?
Yes, it was, I loved working on those projects. They were real roller coasters, really interesting projects where one was able to come up with ideas, realize them, even build some of them in a fraction of the time of designing a project here in the UK. You know, some of these things were built within 2 years of being conceived. and they're very big projects, like big hotel or a big tower, apartment tower, you know, the King Key Tower. And I was extremely grateful to Farrell, Terry and the office to allow me to work on those projects. And I think it's given me a broader view of the world, understanding of financial projects bigger than those that I'm involved in now. And it has allowed me to sort of be happy in the world that I'm now in a way. You know, it wasn't that I was unhappy in that world. It was just something I felt I only had so many years that I could do that for. Yeah. I didn't feel I could spend my whole career on an airplane going to China delivering massive
projects.
Yeah. There are people who can, and I admire that, but it's not for me in that same way. Yeah,
I suppose you have to go through that process to discover what is for you. I suppose that brings us on naturally to, you know, discovering what is for you and discovering you want to launch your own practice, which is 2003, 2004.
That's right, yes.
It's interesting that roughly the sort of time Duncan Morris, who was speaking to Mary last week, conceived her and Joe's practice. There seemed to be a lot of people starting those practices 2003, 2004, before the recession, I guess.
Yes.
The next kind of generation coming through of, you know, of practices doing interesting work. Sort of interested in what, partly was there something we were talking about earlier on about there being something particular of a time when people are working. Was there something about that early 2000s and about people starting practices? And
I don't think I set up because of peer group pressure particularly. I think it may well have been something. I'd reached 40 years of age,
right?
And I thought, and my children were frankly got to a stage where I felt I could almost sort of leave them, they'd be okay, they'd survive, you know. I could just put them out on the street, they'd be okay. I'm sure they don't like that idea, but anyway, it was something where I felt my responsibilities as a father were slightly lesser than they had been. Yeah. And at the same time, Michael Wilford, James Sterling's partner, rang me up and said, I've got a project. It's too big. I don't have an office. I know that you'd like to, you've been itching to for a while. Would you like to join forces with me? And it was a wonderful opportunity for a museum in Africa, a museum of African art and culture. And for me, that was just something that I just thought, wow, yes, I should do it. There's only these opportunities only come along, you know, once in a lifetime. So
lucky, yeah.
it gave us a fee. Between us, we worked up a scheme, and Michael and I went over several times to visit the client and develop the ideas. And it was a real pleasure. And it got me thinking independently, outside of the box, of taking a leap, walking the plank.
You were at Farrell's.
I was at Farrell's, and I decided to leave. And Terry was very good. He totally understood. He was totally relaxed about it. And we're still good friends. And I think he a little disappointed, perhaps, but maybe not. Who knows? Straight after I'd left, I was still in touch, and we were doing projects, and I was fulfilling work that I was felt obliged in a way to complete for him. That was a good period. Yeah.
You used that term, walking the plank. I mean, did it feel like a jump into the unknown?
Well, having been in practice for quite some time, I would say best part of 14 years, working for somebody else, admittedly in a quite senior roles, design director and associate and things, it was quite a step to suddenly take on the responsibility of running the finances, making sure contracts were in place, all these things that I hadn't actually been doing an awful lot of, all of a sudden. And that was a challenge, and fortunately one I overcame. Yeah. Right. And largely by looking around and saying, well, who can I collaborate with to get this through the door? And I think the art of collaboration is something an architect has to be good at, really. And you have to be a jack of all trades in many ways. But I think learning to collaborate with people who are perhaps better than you at certain things is very important to driving success.
Okay. So you say you're 16 in the practice now. Some in London, now an office in Bath?
Yes. I have a small office in Bath. My interest in Bath is really, it's a wonderful Georgian city.
Yeah.
It's a highly competitive environment for an architect, I have to say. Bath is a great city, and has all those attributes of street spaces, and it's one of the finest cities in the world, obviously, in terms of its architecture and layout and design. But there's also the background of my brother-in-law, who I studied with at Oxford Brookes, and he actually was somebody who suggested it in the first place. He said he needed work, and I was giving him work from London. He said, well, why don't I set up an office here and we collaborate on work, and we do that. And so that's the first project that came out of the office was Gasworks, which was quite a bold project we designed here in London, and then Harry pursued it and carried it through with the client. And it's a lovely project. It's Cotswold stone and Corten steel. It's a really
heavy materials again.
Heavy materials, so
solid and
yes, yeah.
So we might, maybe jumping right back now. You mentioned you studied at Oxford Brookes. Regular architecture degree,
Oxford Brookes was interesting at the time. It was Oxford Polytechnic, and I went there because I loved the city of Oxford, and I had a place. They gave me a place ahead of me wanting to take a year out, which I did. I went to Australia and traveled around Australia, and then came back and really enjoyed this completely different course to what I'd imagined, where we were learning, sort of various construction modules, all sorts of aspects of architecture. It's quite practical and pluralistic in a way. There wasn't a sort of distinctive, this is the architecture of this school. It was about discovery and helping you as an young architect find your own voice and language, but providing all the means to get there. And we had some great tutors, Charlie Mann, I remember, and Leila Shamash, and unfortunately these people are no longer, but anyway, there were some great people. And some very good people who I still in touch with in the professional world as well, doing some very nice work. So that was a city of spires and quite a dreamy environment. I remember living in Piddington, which was outside Oxford, in my final year, and Air Vice Marshal Maynard was the landlord who kept a parrot, and his parrot would always say, "Is it time for tea?" And other such expletives, which I can't repeat on the radio.
Yeah, right.
But he was quite a character, and we used to drive. I had a motorcycle and sidecar, and I had a girlfriend at the time who used to enjoy the ride in the sidecar, right. And I'd put my drawings in the sidecar, and we'd go to school and present. You know, so it was great. Yeah.
So I can see Oxford being a, city of Oxford being a formative influence, I guess, in terms of that kind of conservation work you're doing now.
Yeah.
Australia is an interesting.
Well, you know, I think I was. I'd
influenced
left school
by contrast, maybe. Or
yeah, I'd been caged at boarding school.
Where did you go to school?
St. John's in Leatherhead, which was great school. But it was quite a kind of an unusual environment to be in.
Right.
Having been in state schools until I was 13, and then being put through that was my own choice, in fact, because my father was a banker. And at that time, when you were successful in your field in banking, you had to move to London, but only gradually. Right. You'd go via all the shires, it seemed to me. So your family had to move with you. And so we were always on the move, you know, like every 3 or 4 years, we were moving to a different city or town. And ended up in London, and he ended up in London, and I sort of, as a young lad, was elected to go to boarding school because I wanted a bit more stability and to make friends that perhaps
didn't
I would
move
stick
everything.
Around with.
And where's the family home originally? Moved a lot.
I was born in Dewsbury, in West Yorkshire, and Dewsbury's quite a working town, a mill town. And I remember some bizarre things like Caddy's ice cream parlour and my grandfather's watch mending shop, which was right in the market square called Shires. He was a jeweller and an upstanding member of the local community there. And my mum and dad lived just not far from each other, and they'd met at Sweethearts at school, really, and that's how they got together. Yorkshire is a very distant thing for me, but in a way, it's when I go back there, I go to the Dales where my parents live now, and they live near Settle, and it's just gorgeous. I mean, it's the most amazing landscape with dry stone walls rich green fields. It really is God's own land. It's amazing. Yeah.
But no, you say father was a banker. Where did the architectural influence come from?
I think I largely developed them through the encouragement of my art master at school. That was one of the other good things of the school, was that it was a very independent art master. He would encourage us to go to the boozer every now and then and have a drink on a Friday just to get out and relax. And he would also encourage us to think out of the side of the box. And so we'd have life drawing classes, unofficial, and things like that. And we'd have, he'd encourage us to use colour and texture and things. And then at the end of it, and after doing my art A-level, he suggested, why not go for architecture? Because, you seem to be interested in sculptural things. And I thought, well, no, let's have a look at that. Yeah. So, and I did, and I got carried away with it. And I started applying to loads of schools of architecture at the age of 17, knowing that I wanted to have a year out with my school friends.
Yeah.
And then knowing that I wanted to do architecture, it became this kind of personal goal. and something that my father couldn't control. As long as I was able to survive financially by having jobs in the meantime, that is what I did. Yeah.
So you got the place in Oxford.
Got the place,
and then went off traveling.
Yes, and
for a year.
Yeah. And I think it was really formative for me at the time. It really gave me a bit more independence. And although I think being at school away from parents gives you independence, gave you a further confidence in your independence and what your abilities could be.
Right.
We used to sell paintings door to door in Australia as a way of making a living. As a group of us who would.
Trading off your artistic background.
Yes. And that gave me also, being at Oxford, gave me that confidence of actually being able to learn to draw. And it was something that, I developed at school, but I so much more confident as I went through university and Polytechnic at Oxford at the time to learn to draw, to convey ideas and buildings through making things and drawing things. And that's something which, you never forget, really. Yeah.
That's amazing, the vision of a few English lads turning up at an English accent in Australia selling artwork. There's
yes.
A story there. So 3 years then in Oxford, and then straight away, to the Macintosh.
Yes, I did. Not straight out. I did my year out with Levitt Bernstein, David Levitt. That was a really interesting project I worked on. Was
in London, right.
In Liverpool Road in Islington, the old hospital site. Okay. And that was quite something to be able to sort of be involved in producing. I think there were about three or four of us just producing all the working drawings within a matter of 6 months. And I learned to draw with pencil on plastic film in those days. Anyway, that was a good formative experience. And then I went on to the Macintosh in Glasgow, and after meeting my wife Sarah, in fact, whose family are all architects, as I mentioned, her younger brother and her elder brother is an architect for the Spitalfields Trust today and here in London. And her father was an architect for the Civic Trust in the Northeast, and her mother was also involved in the repair and restoration of old buildings. So actually this started to come in even stronger through the family on the other side, in terms of my own approach to architecture as well.
Right. And so part two is a year in Glasgow.
Year in Glasgow was just like flew by. It was wonderful. We had some great tutors, Andy McMillan and Izzy Metstein, Mark Baines. And these people had such strong ideas of the city that you were able to kind of test other views with, and they really expected you to stand up and hold your own, particularly at crits, and you learnt to take the flak. And I think that skill is still valuable today as an architect. You have to learn to take the flak and pause, reflect, and then start again with equal vigour, but without aggression, of course, but with a sense of purpose and new direction.
And is that something the Mac is known for? Is that
I think at the time and certainly today, my son's just finished there, for example, and he's
training as an architect.
And I think it is a school that's has got tremendous background. You know, the heritage of Rennie Macintosh, Glasgow as a city of great industrial trade and vigor and life, and all of that is still there today. It's and moving from Oxford to Glasgow as a student was just quite something. You were going up a scale, if in many ways, I think, in terms of capital A architecture of a commercial kind, and a very Scottish kind. You were sort of learning a new identity in a way, and that's where it's really invaluable to be able to switch schools, I think. Because you were learning in different cities intimately about the culture and identity of those cities.
And that was, just wondering, the faced after Oxford with that choice then of where you go next for your, I mean, you had your year out, but then your choice of university for part two. Was it were you choosing the school? Were you choosing the city? How do architects choose there? Is it by reputation of the university?
I think by then it was, you know, it was the reputation of the university and the city itself, and you know, the fact that the school had some really great students. And I remember in the years ahead of me, there was Charlie Sutherland and Charlie Hussey and Andy Bow, all quite eminent in their own way now in Scotland and down here in London, and many others. And they've all become very successful. And it's interesting how that kind of, it's not peer pressure, but it's something that you're aware of and you learn from people who are in a good environment. It's at that school at that time.
At that time, and you recognised that, did you, at the time, that you were surrounded by other people?
Yeah, it was rich. You were stimulated. And you walked into the school, you go, wow, that's really interesting. And you wanted to look at the drawings, you wanted to look at the models. There was something there that you caught the imagination, fired it. And for me, that was just great. And when the first project we had, I remember in Dollar, there's a wonderful Castle Campbell, in Dollar, which is a sort of ruined castle, and we had to climb up the hill, up this pathway to get to it as a group, and we were all going to investigate the site and come up with a scheme for it for a writer's retreat, and how we kind of had to take a view about the ruins and about how we put new into the old, or against the old, or set it apart from the old. That was a whole debate about new and old and the language of that, and it was still something that's so relevant today.
And then we're sitting in your practice just around the corner from Spitalfields. You're in the process of changing the office, renovating. How long have you been here? How long is there?
Well, we've been, as a practice, we've been in Spitalfields 12 years. I've lived here 25 years. The act of living and working has been very intertwined. And most of our work in the early days came from recommendations from people I knew, as neighbours or people who were moving into the neighbourhood who recognised we had a talent and wanted us to employ us to do things. And over time, that sort of reputation spun out and grown to more London-centric, which is really, really interesting, because it would be a bit restrictive just to be working in one neighbourhood, obviously. As far as the office goes, we've moved three times. We started out at the top of my house in an attic, very much like a weaver from the Huguenot periods, working as an architect in the top of his home. The embarrassment there was bringing potential clients up through the house with young kids and the kind of detritus of family home life to get to the office. So when the opportunity presented itself, we were able to get a property across the road which had a nice big sort of working shed at the back, which would formerly been a joinery workshop for many of the joiners in the neighbourhood. And so that made a good office. And from 2007 to 2015 or something like that, we had a good office environment in that. And then we got to a point where we needed to move. We got to a point where we couldn't really fit many more people in there. And so the opportunity arose, corner of Fashion Street. We are in this, what is the old Queen's Head pub, corner of Fashion Commercial, with my landlord, who had been a client and still is. He had inherited, well, not inherited, he'd bought this building off the bank of Bilbao.
Wow.
Strange connection. It had, as I said, it had been a pub, and we're in it. What we're doing now is restoring it around our ears whilst we sit in these desks, restoring the exterior, adding to the top, and putting back the original windows, restoring the brickwork, bringing back hopefully some of the story of the original pub that was built when this street, Commercial Street, was sort of, if you like, an Act of Parliament had been passed to drive this new street through from the docks to the West End in order to safely bring goods from the docks into the West End. Up until then, there'd been a really quite a difficult path for many of the deliveries and much theft. And yeah.
this was the safe street, the commercial street that would...
That was why it came about in about 1820s. This pub was built at that time.
Right.
So it was called the Queen's Head. We think after Queen Charlotte was really. It's been interesting to unearth that story.
The history of your own.
Hopefully, we can recreate that in the more public ground floor of the aspect of the building in the future.
And so that's the plan to slightly open up. Is it that front?
Yes, we'll have an office which has its own entrance, One Fashion Street, which is rediscovered the number, which is in the old. Has a steel. We found the steel in the brickwork, which was the framed opening through to the barrel store for the bar, and so that now will become our entrance to our atelier office, and then through up the stair and with two studios and a kitchen and a roof terrace on the very top of the building, and the ground floor where the public bar would have been could well be a coffee bar or a gallery or a yoga studio or some aspect, as well as meeting space, of course, for the office. I like the idea of it being able to offer something back in a way to allow community use of the building outside normal office hours and things as well. Yeah,
it's really exciting. I'd say this whole area is, you can feel the buzz and the noise and the kind of exchange of ideas taking place outside. It's a real...
Yes, I think it is interesting. There's a lot of startups, a lot of innovative thinking going on in this neighbourhood, and I like the grime and the grit. I've never ached to live in a smoother, posher clime. I really do like the character of this neighbourhood very much, and it's deep seated inside all our family as well. I know, And within the staff here, I think they appreciate that as well. They like the fact they can go somewhere different for lunch every day and they can sit in a different space. It's rewarding in that regard, yeah.
And no concern, I mean, you talked with a few people about gentrification and about the kind of risks in the area in 5 years, in 10 years.
Well, it's interesting you say that, you raise that, because it was always a concern that early settlers feel slightly cynical, perhaps, of big development, and quite rightly so. I mean, I think it's too easy, as we mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, the idea of tabula rasa, clearing the site and starting again, was tempting, I think, in the 70s. And there are some great heroes who saved the neighbourhood. You know, people like Dan Cruikshank, fantastic what they achieved in their lives to stop, crazy development. And now I think the world is a much more sophisticated place, infinitely. I think it's not on a par with that now. With architects, designers, planners, developers, all so much more sophisticated in their approach to development and making places. Making places is the most important thing, and then the architecture follows. And it's about having the right ideas for making places that are relevant to the people who live around them already. That in any place, there are seeds of what it should be. Just need to find them.
Yeah. That's a real optimistic view of London. I mean, it's a real positive.
Yeah.
And I know you're doing some work with Tower Hamlets in terms of advice and in terms of what's your role with?
For years, I've given advice in the form of a conservation advisory panel, and then it became later a design advisory panel. And for me, it's always been about design. I'm not consciously a conservation architect. I have to point that out. It's just something that I find myself within. And I like to think of myself as a modernist, somebody who likes to see cities in a modern way, but working within a historic context. And I think that's where in my time, I've been, I think for 12 years or maybe more, I've been helping advise Tower Hamlets with a whole group of other people, it has to be said, on a monthly basis down at Mulberry Place on their larger scale schemes, where they often struggle, frankly, because they don't have the staff or the time or the professional experience to give the commentary that the scheme demands. And frequently we find ourselves really tearing our hair out and saying, how could you possibly let the scheme get to this stage or whatever, you know, but we hopefully we give some ammunition and some power to the planning process by passing our comments and influencing the world around us in that way.
And is your experience of working, do you think planning departments are understaffed? Do you think,
Yes, I think they are. I think you find some of the, you know, the bigger ones like City of London, Corporation of London, and Westminster and others. They may not agree, but they're probably relatively well staffed with pretty good staff. Others struggle, and I know that we struggle in this borough. I don't think there's anybody who would say who wouldn't don't, but they are doing some tremendous things, and there will be some really great projects come out in time. I just hope that, you know, more time is spent in the process of developing these designs than perhaps, you know, has been in the past. Yeah,
that's really interesting. The sort of giving, a lot of architects spend a lot of time giving back, you know, in terms of advice and time and reflection. Obviously doing a lot of work with a festival in terms of helping, you know, shape festival ideas and things. Do you think, you know, I guess across the profession, it does seem architects tend to want to give a lot back?
Yeah, maybe it's something common to architects, I'm not sure. It's something architects who are interested in in developing ideas that are relevant to particular neighbourhoods thrive off, I think, is the idea of a fresh situation. It's like being at a review in college and university, where you find yourself, and I often used to be invited to Bartlett and to other schools, where you'd sit in and you'd say what you thought about a student's work. And that is a privilege in a way, but it's something which you develop your own ideas as an architect in that position to responses to problems which you hadn't necessarily come across in your professional life. And I think we all are slightly addicted to that, you know. We like the idea of imagining a different world. And so we are suckers for giving out perhaps more than we get.
And on that note, you've recently served unpaid as a REBA Awards judge. Yeah, and we were talking just before we started recording about that awards process and about,
yes,
judging other buildings.
I think it's an amazing process, particularly the way the RABA does it. I think the fact that we actually bother to visit the buildings, there's very few awards that do that, is tremendous. The assessment panel is not just architects, lay people and educationalists and or others, and I think that is a really, really valuable process for assessing quality in the built environment. I can't speak highly enough of it, really. I think I enjoyed my 4 days, for example, going around the southwest. I really hadn't seen that much in 4 days of the southwest. Some of it was familiar and some of it wasn't, but incredible variety from the smallest project to the largest. Really, really was rewarding. And that's another aspect of being an architect. You just, you're constantly learning. You're sort of absorbing like a sponge your environment, and then that comes through in your work and you see other people's ideas. I think it's really interesting.
And I suppose the other thing I need to ask, really, and this is again becoming a bit of a theme in some of these conversations, and it's not a selecting theme, but it's you've done the cycle to, I mean, we're talking about going around and visiting and looking at the world around you.
Yes,
the cycle to Mipin, done that 2 years now, a couple of years?
I've done it for 3 years now. So next year will be my fourth if I get on the list again.
Right.
But it's something I found, it energizes the year. It's incredible how the training regime for a 6-day ride to the south of France has kind of led me to take up static bike training in the gym in Shoreditch House and getting on with so many people there. And it's opened up a whole world of social world of way meeting, not just architects, engineers and developers and all sorts of people. And seeing the world as a cyclist, you realize that, you know, it's one thing, you're on a bicycle, you're focused, you cannot focus on anything else apart from your safety and what's ahead of you and what the weather's like. Those things are all conditions that are all, affecting you as a human in charge of your bicycle. And as a consequence, I don't cycle that much in the city because I'm slightly kind of anxious of being knocked off because I'm easily distracted by looking at buildings and things like that. So I'm my own worst enemy in that regard. So I kind of recognize that. And I do cycle locally, but I don't do sort of big rides across the city to get to a meeting, partly because I'd arrive in a sweaty heap. But it's certainly something that I do enjoy, and I think it will energize my life, help me live longer and all that sort of thing. So it's good for the health. Yeah,
but I mean, just in terms of, I mean, the other thing I just wanted to ask was about vision for the practice.
Yes.
You're 16 or so now as a firm.
Yeah.
Is there a grand plan? You know, do you see, you know, you're happy with the size and the scale and the work you're doing now? Are there other?
Yeah, there isn't so much a grand plan as a plan to do more interesting work as all the time.
A plan to be grand,
perhaps a plan to be grand. Yes, I always enjoyed that scale of work when I was working at Sterling's office. Very much so. It's you know, something I really would love and relished to do, an embassy, for example, building, or a gallery building. But I think it would very much stem from the character of our work that we already do. So I would see it as a logical sequence once and if it presented itself. I think, yes, there are young people in my office who are a lot younger than I who deserve, and I think I would encourage to have a future within this fold and grow the practice under themselves as well. So I would like to see us grow to a larger scale practice if it's possible. If the projects are there, yes, I think, why not? We have a good leadership with myself and Gideon and Matthew, and we have some good associates, and all of those people are quite capable of taking, you know, more work on their shoulders and leading from the front. I think the important thing with growing practices is to do it slowly and to allow the seeds of change to bed in, rather than to grow like a wildflower too quickly and
shrink again. I
think I'm very, very aware of recessions and the economic environment, how they can bitterly affect a practice. And it's a dreadful thing to have to lay people off. It's no fun at all for anybody. So I wouldn't want to be in that situation too readily. So yes, I'm very optimistic about the future. I'm relatively young still. I'd like to think I would carry on until I drop, and it's a vocation which one chooses, and you either love it or hate it and move out. But I love it, and the more I do, the more I want to do, and I think that is infectious in people who work with me, so I expect the same of them.
Fantastic. I think that's an ideal spot to end, a really upbeat note.
Thank you
so much for your time. You're really generous. I'm conscious of how much architects have got to do and how generous people have been with their time, so thank you again. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Chris Dyson. You can find out more about Chris and his work at architecturemasters.org. If you've enjoyed the podcast, then why not share it with a friend? You can also subscribe by searching for Architecture Masters in your podcast app. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.